Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a bi-weekly show about gardening, agriculture, and local producers, meant to encourage, educate, and empower local gardeners. We strive to provide diverse voices by interviewing local experts and garden enthusiasts. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. This is our 12th episode, and it will be airing on Halloween on a full moon. For this episode, we talked to Carolyn Westbrook of Woda Botanicals and Yarrow Hinnant about plant lore, plant medicines, and herbalism. We also interviewed Kathy Brewster of Nanwalek, but plan on featuring her on a future episode due to time constraints. Let's get this started.
So this is the magic of radio.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Would you guys introduce yourselves?
I'm Carolyn Westbrook, and we are here at Woda, which is my little herb shop on Lake Street. I have been living around Homer for just about 4 years now.
I'm Yarrow Hinnant, also living in Homer area for about 4 years, herbalist and wildcrafter.
How did you guys get into herbalism?
I was born into it. I was raised in a household that used herbal remedies in conjunction with conventional medicine. So, yeah, herbal medicine has always been my default.
I've always been fascinated with plants. Early on, it was mostly when I was a kid, it was an interest in which plants I could eat. And then as I got a little bit older, I started being interested in the medicinal uses and historical uses. Both in indigenous cultures and in the what's I now recognize as the Western herbal tradition.
So, Carolyn, do you remember any of these herbal remedies as a child?
Some of my first memories about medicine or having to take medicine actually have to do with how weird I thought it was that I never got the quote-unquote regular medicine that all the other kids were getting. Specifically, I remember missing out on Pepto-Bismol, which I still have not had a chance to sample.
Oh my gosh, you're missing out.
But other than that, my first memory of actually consuming herbal medicine, my mom would put tinctures, which are an alcohol extract of an herb, into warm water to kind of dilute them. And I think also the idea was to have some of the alcohol evaporate off. But I actually mainly remember the taste of brandy.
So can you talk about the difference between, say, a tincture and is there one called a decoction? Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah. So there are many, many different ways that we extract herbs or turn herbs into something we're going to consume. So tinctures are specifically a plant extracted into alcohol. Alcohol is used as the solvent to strip some of the constituents you want from the plant. Decoctions are a water-based extraction process. Essential oils are one that we hear about really frequently, which is traditionally a steam distillation, but now there are other modern industrial ways to extract essential oils also. One of them being to use like CO2 gas and other complicated things I'm not familiar with, acetums, so using acids like vinegar to extract a plant is another common and very old tradition, making things like fire ciders people might have heard of. We can also make salves, oils that are not essential oils, but just plants extracted into a fixed oil like olive oil, and the list goes on and on and on and on.
So Yarrow, you had mentioned learning about historic Western uses of plants versus the indigenous ways of using them. Is there anything that you've learned as differences between the two?
mostly just in historical context. Many indigenous plant uses go back as long as people have lived on the land. And those uses are, in many cases, still intact within those communities. There are occasions where we have ethnobotanists or ethnographers who've recorded that information. Around here, we have Priscilla Russell's books, for example, which record some of the plant uses with both the Dena'ina and the people of Nanwalek area. With the Western tradition, it's more of a recent thing, but traditional Western medicine can be traced back at least into the 1800s. And from that, that was kind of reconstructing some of the more ancient body of knowledge coming out of Europe and the Americas, but kind of fusing it with modern science. That in particular is where Western medicine, I would say, differs from the indigenous use.
So I've read Priscilla Russell's book, I think the Dena'ina Plant Lore. One thing I like about that book is that it has the native names and kind of like a translation. And the one that I remember distinctly is with Devil's Club. The native name, the translation of it was Prickly Big Big, which was very appropriate because it's kind of the biggest prickly thing. But also there's two names, which also in what I was reading denotes that when you get stung by Devil's Club, it stings you twice. So I'm wondering what is something that we can tell by the names of plants, or if there's any interesting allegories that you have regarding plant names, either indigenous or Western, or using the common names.
There's usually a good story behind most of these. Devil's Club is one of those that has that, both in the common name and in the Latin name, Oplopanax horridus. The horridus is easy enough to figure out, but the Oplopanax part, Panax is borrowed from the Latin name, the genus name for ginseng. The Oplo part is referring to hoplites, the Greek armored phalanx divisions, which you can see where that's going with the Devil's Club and its spines.
So because they were the ones that had the big spears.
Yep, big spears, bristling all over, so to speak. There's a lot of lore associated with plant names that can get really interesting. I love learning the local native names for the reason you just described. There's a lot of just interesting insight into the nature of the plant and how people relate to it. Common names, in a more general sense, especially in English, can get kind of tricky because a lot of times it carries colonial baggage or misunderstanding, like Devil's Club in itself, you know, is kind of referencing a Western cultural or mythological tradition. But it can be really interesting to explore the origins of the names. And when you get into the Latin names, which is probably the most specific way cross-culturally to refer to plants, even those are full of lore specific to various historical contexts or to the people that first encountered those plants in the Western tradition, whatever the case may be.
So Yarrow, how do you use Devil's Club root? When do you harvest it, and what's it good for?
So Devil's Club, it's an adaptogen. It's in the ginseng family. It's pretty closely related to true ginseng. It's native to Asia. And Devil's Club acts very effectively on the respiratory system and to some degree on the digestive system. There are some other uses that you often see in books, and some of them are myths. It's worth checking your sources and trying to track down true source material or scientific studies, or stay within the bounds of traditional indigenous use, where those in the past have been kind of blurred. One of the common myths that you hear associated with Devil's Club is that it is used as a treatment for diabetes. That's not true, or it's not effective in that regard. And that's something that has been repeatedly attributed to traditional native use, but actually does not show up in any of those records if you look deeper back into the history of those uses. So which part of it to use and when to harvest? You get different people with different preferences in that. My preference is to harvest it in the autumn as the leaves are turning yellow, but before they fall off the plant entirely. And that's based on having harvested it around those times and at other times and preferring the flavor and what I perceive to be the constituent base of the plant at that period. If you harvest it in summer when the leaves are green, you get a very different flavor profile and obviously a different chemical profile. the reading that I've done points towards the having a better overall set of factors in the fall harvested root. Root, in this case, is kind of a tricky concept. So Devil's Club has a rhizomatic growth pattern. Its stem basically continues winding around underneath the duff or organic debris in the forest areas where it grows. And if you track that, you'll hit an area where the spines that are common on the above ground or above duff stem kind of fade away, but you're still dealing with what seems like a stem. And eventually you'll find very small roots, usually branching off that stem running into the ground. But you don't have to try to track those down. What I find to be the best part to harvest is I work down the plant stem until the thorns stop, and then I snip that off with a pair of pruners and get, depending on how much I'm trying to harvest, another foot or two of that below the duff, sometimes in the soil, but usually just beneath the leaf litter part of the stem, and snip that off as well. And I may include some of the true roots in a preparation as well, but the main part you're going for is the cambium of that stem section that's beneath the duff. The cambium is the living tissue layer, the inner bark of the Devil's Club plant. So what I'll often do is handle it with a pair of heavy leather gloves, because the thorns can be, they sting you twice, as you mentioned earlier. And with a heavy enough pair of gloves, you can actually kind of grip the stem carefully where there still are spines and work, kind of wring it back and forth as though you're wringing out a washcloth or something, and break many of the spines off and make it easier to put in your backpack and carry home and deal with later. Some people just snip that stem section into small pieces for preparation. I prefer to actually peel the cambium layer off of the stem and then also scrape away the outer bark. So I'm left with only the cambium layer, which is definitely the most potent part where the chemicals are concentrated, the constituents rather. Doing it that way, I can play with the ratios a little bit and end up with a very powerful medicine that you only need a few drops of typically. Many people would just cut the whole stem section. In that case, you're getting a lot of the inner wood also. There's several reasons I peel it off. One is for potency, and the other is because I really like the wood material itself. It's really beautiful, pale colored. And traditionally, a lot of people would use that for tools, for amulets, for a variety of different purposes. So I kind of like to carve it or just kind of use it as decoration, have it around for various other purposes. And then that inner bark or cambium material where the plant constituents are concentrated, that can be either cooked as a decoction, which is basically a tea that you simmer for at least 20 minutes, sometimes much longer, depending on the plant. And you could drink that decoction, although that preparation, it's only going to be good for 2 or 3 days, maybe a week or more if you refrigerate the brew after you've made it. The most effective way to preserve most plant constituents long-term is in a tincture, which is usually with alcohol. With some plants, you can also use glycerin or vinegar. It kind of depends on what you're trying to extract out of them. But an alcohol tincture is shelf-stable for at least 10 years, and in many cases, a well-made tincture that's made at the proper ratios of weight to volume of plant matter to volume of solvent. There have been some analyses done of very old tinctures. I heard about one this summer that was over 90 years old, and it was tested in a lab, and it was found to have the same set of constituents totally stable after over 90 years. So it is possible to have things last that long if it's made well. And that shelf stability is excellent if you're trying to make a harvest once a year or once every few years and slowly build up your home medicine cabinet or apothecary one plant at a time.
Somebody had told me about this years ago, and I would do this every year, where you take the, as you say, the inner bark from the root and you infuse it in red wine. Have you ever tried that before?
I haven't.
Okay, you can make this psychotropic beverage. I would make it every year, and I liked it. It kind of had a very earthy taste to it. You have to use a wine that's not still fermenting, so you couldn't brew the wine yourself. And I tried it with friends, and one of my friends was like, this tastes like a fine scotch. And the other one's like, this tastes like you know?
So in my role here in the herb shop, folks will come in and often ask for a plant by the name that they call it. And sometimes that's perfectly obvious. I know exactly what they're talking about. And other times we really have to kind of parse out what specifically they're actually looking for, because a plant may have many common names. Even more confusing, the same common name may be used to refer to many different plants. So the example that I always use is mugwort or wormwood, or as many locals in Alaska know it, stinkweed. Yeah, which is typically these names are used to describe many members of the Artemisia genus. So when we get to the botanical name, it's going to have, the Latin name is going to have two words, a genus and a species. So, you know, mugworts and wormwoods are Artemisia vulgaris, Artemisia absinthum, which absinthe, the famous drink absinthe has this herb in it. But even our local wormwoods or mugworts are Artemisia tillisii. I don't know if I'm saying the Latin right, and Artemisia frigida. So I think I was just looking today and there's over 200 plants in this genus, and many, many of them could be called mugwort or wormwood. So it's a fun one to kind of use as an example to say, like, well, are you looking for mugwort or are you looking for wormwood or maybe something completely different? That plant also has one of these great folkloric names for folk medicine uses, which is wormwood.
Does it get rid of worms?
It does, in fact. It's a really popular antiparasitic in many of the places where it's found growing. The people who've lived on those areas for a long time will have uses that have to do with treating parasites. Some of the other uses for wormwood, when it's dried, it will often be wrapped into bundles and used kind of to smoke as a large incense. And that smoke is then used in different spiritual or mythic practices. A woman walked in here once. I had a bunch of our local wormwood hanging from strings drying. And she said to me, she said, when we do a sauna, we grab, if anybody can picture this plant, it's about as long as my forearm, and it has these big, floppy, flat, palm kind of sized leaves. She said, we use it, and she lifted her hand over her back and kind of swatted herself. They use it when they're saunaing. They'll take it out and kind of slap their body with it, which just sounded so refreshing to be hot and sweaty and then have this green kind of soft leaf to get into your pores. It's a very aromatic plant. It has a number of essential oils and things that could make you smell pretty good, I would imagine.
These various Artemisias are a great example of plants that, well, for one, many of them are interchangeable in use. Not all of them, but Artemisia tillisii, the uses and the chemical constituents overlap quite a bit with other common herbs in Western North America and native herbs to Europe that are in the same genus. And it's a great example of where there's actually been a decent amount of scientific research done on this plant. Overwhelmingly, it backs up many, many of the indigenous uses, especially as we have them recorded in this region. There's some excellent writing in Michael Moore's book, Michael Moore, the Western Herbalist, not the filmmaker. He gets into some of the studies and points out the corollary there between the traditional use and the what's now been verified, particularly in some of these Artemisias being used to treat gastritis and gastric ulcers, acting as an antioxidant and anti-inflammatory to tissues, both in the respiratory tract and the gastrointestinal system, as well as many of the topical uses. Wormwood or mugwort, these plants are excellent topically, either as a tea or fresh, or particularly well as an acetum, which is a tincture that's made with vinegar as the solvent, which is very safe and easy to do at home. And the vinegar itself is often beneficial to irritated or bruised skin. One thing I would throw in with the Artemisias, it's good to do your research and make sure it's appropriate for you. Many of them are not appropriate if you're pregnant or looking to become pregnant, especially in larger doses. Topically, though, the switches, as Carolyn mentioned, in sauna, as a hot pack on sore or bruised muscles. And one of my favorite uses of them is the fresh sprigs of any of them, but the ones that smell the best to you, placed in footwear while hiking, is actually quite a nice experience. When you end your long day hiking and crawl into your tent at night, it makes the experience a lot more pleasant when you take your boots off.
Where do you find this plant growing?
So Artemisia tillisii is our most common local Artemisia, and I've seen it anywhere from on the sand dunes at the beach. There's some, if you walk up Bishop's Beach, you'll see some growing in the more recently disturbed landslide areas. But from there, you'll find it in open, sunny meadows all the way up into the alpine. And once you're in the alpine, you're also likely to start seeing Artemisia frigida and any number of half a dozen other really small, beautiful Artemisias as well.
Do you harvest it when it's in its leaf form or when it starts to kind of gets very tiny little seeds, little flowers, I guess?
Either is fine. I tend to prefer it right as it begins to flower. I feel like that's the point where I notice the most pungent smells and the most potent effects overall.
A note I'll make about harvesting anything, especially from the wild. I mean, harvest whatever you want from your garden, of course. Whenever we're going out into the wild, we want to encourage folks to practice what we call ethical wildcrafting. So first, you always want to identify the plant living in a colony that is healthy. So if the area has been disturbed, there's only a few of them, they're just kind of getting a hold there, let them go, you know, let the stand reestablish. If you can identify a stand that's nice and healthy, meaning there are lots of individuals there, then I tend to practice a 20% rule, which is I would never take more than 20% of what I consider to be a healthy stand. Typically for me, it's a lot less than that because I'm a very timid wild crafter. It takes me forever to get my fill for the day because I just don't want to take too much. And really, we can pretty easily as humans decimate a wild population of plants. So be aware that, you know, in some areas, we're really not allowed to take things. And even if you are, do just be aware that if you decimate a population, some of these plants take a very long time to reestablish.
Besides wildcrafting, what herbs do you grow yourself in your personal gardens?
How much time do you have? The list is pretty long. Beginning with Artemisias, I'm growing Artemisia tillisii, our local native herb. I started it from seed, and it perennializes well. So I've started spreading that around the property. I'm also growing an Artemisia japonica, which is it's a native to Eastern Asia, and that's a really beautiful plant. That is effectively perennial here. There's also, not in my garden, but another Artemisia that's very beautiful that you see around town is Artemisia ludoviciana, and there's several cultivated varieties of that one that you'll see in some folks' gardens. I grow a number of other herbs, chamomiles, bee balms, valerian, echinacea. I particularly like establishing native plants on my property that you would find at that elevation and aspect, but that aren't currently there. So I'm introducing a number of those, including Devil's Club, hoping to kind of give it a boost in that area, and goldenrod, because I like using that for tea. But I try not to take on too many plants that have a reputation for getting out of control. There are a number of beautiful garden plants, including some medicinals, that can get kind of out of bounds in the local environment. But if you're actively gardening and engaged with that process and harvesting for medicinal uses, it's pretty easy to keep things under control, with the exception maybe of some things like mints, which it's not really advisable to plant into a garden bed unless you really intend to keep up on it.
Besides mints, what are some other examples?
There are a number of Veronica genus plants, including Veronica grandiflora, which is commonly known as Aleutian speedwell. It's a diminutive, very beautiful little plant with purple flowers. It has a reputation for getting quite out of control in local gardens.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It's blooming right now in my garden.
Yeah, it's a great plant, and you'll see it around, but it's one of those that can get out of bounds pretty quickly. And there are several other Veronicas as well, but I don't want to speak badly with the whole genus. There are also a bunch of Veronicas that are very well behaved and easy to manage in the garden.
This is something that you would use medicinally?
I don't know of uses for the Veronica grandiflora, but many of the other Veronicas do have traditional uses. One of the common names that several of them have been tagged with is speedwell. It's just used as a general tonic tea, tonifying meaning astringent to various body tissues and just a health-promoting tea. So some of them have that aspect. The grandiflora would be kind of difficult to harvest, I think, in mass.
When we're talking about harvesting, what season is the best to harvest, depending on what your intention is?
Yeah, and this is something that also comes up here in my shop, that folks will walk in and, oh, I just got this or I got that. And then we can kind of have a conversation about, like, well, it's really great that you love chaga and somebody just went and got you a bunch of it and it's June. But in fact, and this is a very obscure one, the preferred time to harvest chaga for its medicinal qualities is after it has been below freezing for some time. So winter. That one was very obscure. I'm going to back up and use a little bit of an easier example. So whenever we're harvesting things for their leaves, so mint, actually some people like mint flowers too. But whenever you're harvesting something for its leaf, we want to get it in its vegetative growth stage. So before it flowers specifically, once a plant transitions into its flowering phase, the phytochemical composition in the plant is going to shift towards that flowering event, and that's when we would take the flowers, of course, when they're in good condition before they've gone to seed. Because once the plant has shifted into its seed making phase, then the phytochemicals that we were looking for in those flowers are now shifting. They're becoming a seed making set. So after we've got our nice beautiful flowers, then the seeds happen. Then if we want to harvest roots, now is actually a great time here to harvest roots, because plants, especially perennials, are starting to shift their function into storing energy in their roots for overwintering. And so when we're looking for those root-based constituents, now is often the time when the plant is going to just have a fresh batch of all of that energy sent down into its roots. Similarly, though, folks will, and it is a old tradition to take roots in the spring as well, this idea that the roots are kind of waking up and things are being stimulated in the spring before that vegetative state really gets into effect is also, early spring can be a good time to take roots. So those of you who have things that you want to harvest that are root-based, there's still time.
So I guess chaga was a bad example because it's a mushroom or
yes,
a fungus.
It is a fungus. The fruiting body of the chaga is a sclerotia. I'm looking at Yarrow to get the botanical term right. Yeah. So that's the body that we see outside of the tree that looks like a big black wart.
So Halloween this year is on a full moon. Is there anything that the moon can affect in terms of, you know, when you want to harvest something?
Certainly. A lot of that comes down to your particular affinity for a plant and for the moon, and how you relate to both of those entities. I wouldn't cast any broad general
rules
around that. I would just kind of say that a lot of people do have some specific practices, and that harvesting, especially a plant that you have a deep affinity for or a particular intention for, in concert with certain phases of the moon, can have a beneficial aspect for you. I guess it's, to summarize, it's complicated and personal, and it really depends on what you make of it. But I think that's something that's beautiful in the nature of herbalism, is that it's a very personal thing. It's easy enough to buy a tincture, to take a medicine, and just treat it as a pharmacological product. But plants are usually more complex than that. They tend to draw us in, and we become interested in certain ones, fascinated by the names, the smells, the flavors. And working with the seasons and with the phases of the moon is just another way to deepen that relationship and find ways of connecting to the plant and communicating that make the experience more whole.
What are some roots that you are harvesting right now or during this season?
So I have had my eye on a big comfrey that escaped. So another medicinal plant that can escape up here is comfrey. And there are certainly uses for comfrey leaves. So people will take comfrey leaves all season. But many of the old preparations for comfrey topically. So oils and salves that are healing utilize comfrey root. So this escaped comfrey has been bothering me all year, and instead of killing it, I've let it continue to live because now I am going to go target its roots and take all of its roots. This is outside of my garden. This is not a wild comfrey. This is doomed for the hatchet.
Assuming the weather stays warm for another week or so, I have my eye on some elecampane in the garden, as well as some horseradish that I want to get in. The motivation for harvesting roots up here is pretty great because, of course, the ground freezes, so it is kind of the last chance to plan these projects in advance. And elecampane is one of my favorite ingredients for making into a honeyed cough syrup. It's a really intense aromatic flavor. Not for everyone, perhaps, but the honey really helps, and it is a very effective root medicine for coughs and colds. So looking forward to bringing in some of that.
I'm not entirely familiar with this plant. Does it have giant leaves?
It does. Huge leaves that are generally kind of lance-shaped. It has a bright yellow flower and a large ray, similar to a sunflower. And the one in my garden, I started from seed 2 years ago. I don't know how big the root is going to be at this point. I dug up one of the three plants last spring, and it was a beautiful root, really gnarly, like looks like something just magical and otherworldly. So this one should be interesting. The plant has been towering. It's taller than I am, and I have two of them, I believe. So one of them's going to get dug up, and the other I'm going to leave in the ground and see what it does next year.
Elecampane has one of my favorite common names. So you mentioned it has really big leaves. So picture in your mind's eye dock, just like a classic yellow dock. So elecampane has a common name of elf dock.
I'm looking at this shelf that you have of just all these herbs in jars, and some of them we grow in our garden. Okay, so I'm gonna just look through this, and because I want to see what we grow and I want to know what it's for. So tarragon, it looks like tarragon is an artemisia too. We grow tarragon. We grow valerian. I always hear about valerian root. I don't know what that's for.
Mm-hmm. So valerian is legendary as a sleep aid. Mm-hmm. So as a tea, as a tincture, people will consume it to help them sleep. You'll consume it before bed. If you open that jar, you will notice that I would say it has kind of a peppery smell, like black pepper, but my mom likes to remind me that it smells like feet.
I don't know what that smell is, but
it's like black pepper and dirty socks.
I don't get that, but I do like the smell. It's very distinctive. So yeah, I'm just going to continue looking. Rhodiola, we grow rhodiola, and I don't know what that is used for. We had an herbalist that was living on our farm who no longer lives there, but we still continue to grow all these herbs. We grow lovage. I did not know that you could use the root.
Yeah, lovage root has more, I want to say it's more used traditionally in Chinese medicine, but not one I'm very familiar with.
Rhodiola is a pretty special plant in this region, and we're looking at Rhodiola rosea, which is the Siberian variety. We locally have a plant, it's been renamed several times, but the current name is Rhodiola integrifolia. Rose root, king's crown, these are some of the common names associated with it, and that one's quite common on the rocky bluffs, as well as the alpine areas across the bay in Ketchmack Bay State Park. But the Rhodiola rosea has been studied extensively, especially in Russia, and it is a potent adaptogen, which is a kind of a complex topic to get into here. It's worth doing your own research into, but especially if you're looking for overall energy boost or increasing stamina, if you're a high-performance athlete, there's been a lot of studies in these directions with rhodiola.
Can you give us just the smallest definition of a, what did you call it?
An adaptogen. So an adaptogen, broadly speaking, is a plant or a set of plant constituents that has a modulating effect, usually on multiple body systems at once. So it's almost like a smart drug or chemical in a sense. It can help bring balance to systems of the body that are out of balance. And the unique thing about an adaptogen is that it tends to act in whatever way is needed in the body. And this sounds kind of magical and complicated, and the pharmacology of it is really complicated, and I would get lost trying to explain it here. But adaptogens are really interesting as a concept, very fascinating plants to get into. Ginseng and Devil's Club are both also in that category. Rhodiola, I started out saying it's kind of amazing around here. It's one of the few medicinal herbs, one of the few plants at all. If you buy a seed packet of it, it'll say it's hardy to zone 1. You don't see that very often. And here in Homer, we're somewhere in zone 5B to 6A. Zone 1 is the extreme Arctic. So this is a plant that can survive the coldest, harshest winters. And here, it grows readily. The trick is keeping other things from crowding it out because it is very low profile, growing low to the ground. It also takes between 3 to 5 years to get large enough to harvest. But it's a really beautiful, interesting plant to grow.
So I noticed that you sell a lot of herbs that I would recognize as being used for culinary purposes. Are these also used medicinally?
Yeah, a lot of culinary spices. Actually, I would say that most all culinary spices have crossover therapeutic uses. So, I mean, black pepper is a great example. Totally a culinary spice, also known in most herbal traditions, be it traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, Western traditional herbalism, as a synergist. So the really popular thing with turmeric that everybody is kind of focused on right now with its anti-inflammatory qualities is, oh, but actually you need biopyrenine, which is in black pepper, to absorb the turmeric better. So a lot of these culinary spices are totally crossover therapeutic. Thyme is supposed to be a great respiratory therapeutic. So making tea with thyme leaves is an age-old kind of way to give your breathing ability some nurturing.
I'm curious about your customers. Okay, so I would think that they would typically buy most of these herbs for medicinal purposes, maybe culinary purposes. What are some of the other ways that they might use them?
I mean, I see a pretty good split of folks who come in strictly for their kitchen cabinets for cooking. I also see folks who come in just for teas, things to make into teas. And I actually do see a handful of folks who come in and purchase things to use in ways that I have no idea why you would buy that set of things together or how they're going to use it.
For some ritual?
Perhaps ritual. Yeah, there's definitely more cosmetic uses than I'm privy to, but there are certainly some ritual uses that I'm like, I don't know why you would need that thing. Rare but delightful, those interactions where I'm left with a little bit of mystery of.
What about the ones that have surprised you?
I'm looking at the wall and it's either lovage root or lomatium, which are both plants I'm not very familiar with. I had somebody come in once and get one of those roots and a couple other things, and they said they were going to make a bath soak with it that was supposed to be like beautifying, which is odd because the way that those things smell is like very celery and like almost a little bit spicy. You know, they're not these like lavender, rosy kind of conventional beautifying smells.
What are some things that are like maybe some weeds or some common plants that can be used medicinally around this area?
So quite a few of our common garden weeds, including many of the ones that gardeners are most annoyed to see in their gardens, like chickweed and dandelion, are plants that have a long established use or history of use medicinally. It's probably worth defining that the difference between a medicine and a food and a poison is all one of dosage. Particularly as we're speaking with these weedy plants, it's more of the difference between food and medicine. And this is true of most things. Even water, if you consume enough of it, could do you harm. So the question of dosage is one that is tricky with herbs, and it's very particular to the individual. Kind of circling back to what Carolyn was saying a little bit ago, in terms of prescribing herbs or referring people to certain herbs, it's a subtle art and science, and it's worth getting to know your own body and your own temperament. and then working with established literature to figure out what works best for you, because it can differ quite a bit. Valerian is a very effective sleep aid for some people, but with certain other people whose metabolism is slightly different, it will keep them awake very effectively. So it's a tricky thing to get to know. Back to the question about the weeds, chickweed is very nutritive. It's a very healthy plant to eat. It also has a tonifying effect. Now, tonic is a term that gets thrown around a lot, but literally what a tonic is something that has an astringent action. It causes a localized constriction or contraction of blood vessels, a drawing together. Many people may have used witch hazel in cosmetic application, I suppose, or removal, and that is a very strong astringent. So many, many other plants are also astringent and can be used similarly. Dandelion is another great example of a plant that is both edible, the leaves in particular, and the flower heads earlier in the spring. Dandelion wine is a common popular use. If people are interested or have had positive experiences making dandelion wine, I would encourage them to branch out, use the same principle, and apply it to any number of other flowers, of course making sure they're safe, but branching out with flavors and getting different effects and colors can be pretty delightful with that. Dandelion is the only thing you can make in that way. Dandelion root has a lot of applications. It's considered detoxifying in certain specific ways. It's also edible in smaller amounts, and in higher doses would be considered medicinal. Pineapple weed, not one of my favorites, but it's another one that some people use cosmetically or in very small amounts medicinally as a stimulant to the digestion, as many bitter plants would be as well.
So pineapple weed has another one of these great common name into the folkloric attitude of the plant. So pineapple weed, you may also know it as wild chamomile, which is a very sweet name that harkens on chamomile, these little white flowers that help you sleep and calm you down. But as Yarrow just mentioned, and I've heard other herbalists say, it's not one of their favorites, usually because they find more efficient versions of the same effect in one of what I would call a true chamomile. So some herbalists use the common name dog fennel to refer to our wild
that
chamomile.
That sounds way worse. Why do they associate it with fennel? To me, it doesn't look like fennel.
I think having those fine kind of feathery leaves, sort of like fennel, maybe is where it comes from.
And it's aromatic. It's common for people to kind of wrap aromatics together, even if they aren't particularly similar. In this case, there's pineapple weed has a somewhat sweet fragrance, as does fennel. That I'm not totally sure, but that might have something to do with the name crossover.
When you talk about the common names, we had mentioned wormwood and how it was used for treating worms. Are there any names that are kind of misnomers?
Boneset. There is a common name plant called boneset, which does not heal broken bones.
But I forget the exact lore behind boneset. I believe it was used as a remedy for an ailment that causes brittle or bones that are more likely to break. I'm not totally sure about that, but it's true that it's not a treatment for setting broken bones. That's the Eupatorium genus, or jopieweed is a common name. And that's another plant there are cultivars of that are quite beautiful and that are in some public gardens around. If you want a treasure hunt, there's a really beautiful one somewhere around Homer.
A jopieweed?
Yes, a particular beautiful cultivar of a Eupatorium plant, that commonly known as jopieweed or boneset.
Okay, so there was one other common garden weed that we were thinking about for medicinal or therapeutic uses, and that is yellow dock. Yarrow mentioned to me the other year we saw somebody attempting to remove it after it had already gone to seed, and it was late in the fall like this, and he mentioned to me that the seeds are viable for decades. So the key would be to remove it before it goes to seed. A very intriguing therapeutic use that I stumbled upon in a book at one point is that certain old cultures in North America would utilize this root for a pre-ceremonial cleansing purge. So this root can be supportive to the detoxification process. And when we talk about dosage, this is a good example of that, because a little bit might just you know, kind of stimulate maybe your liver and your kidneys to just produce a little bit of maybe bile or get your fluids moving. But in a large enough dose, you're going to get a purgative effect, which means that whatever digestive contents are in your body are going to exit in a very quick way. In some traditional cultures, this would be a way to prepare for ceremony, to get everything out and be empty and ready to go. So I kind of always think of that when I see yellow dock, that it's like a big warning sign of like a little bit might be good, but too much might create an unpleasant effect.
Dosage is very important. And with many plants, there are other nuances as well, including the time of year that you harvest the plant, which we spoke about a bit. Some other good common examples of that include dandelion and yellow dock. The roots have slightly different chemical constituents in the spring, summer, and fall. And sometimes they're complementary. I've made a dandelion tincture where I combine spring harvested and fall harvested roots to create a broad spectrum dandelion root tincture. The way that you prepare them can also make a big difference. So when I make a yellow dock tincture, I prefer to use a combination of the dried root and the fresh root, and then to do the calculation to find the ideal alcohol percentage that I want to use to get that extraction just perfect. And that's me kind of challenging myself in that case to be as holistic with the plant as possible. It's not necessary to go that in depth, but with some plants, there is a big difference, and it's worth getting to know the plant and delving into reputable sources. I would largely point to certain books in that regard and avoiding, by and large, information that you find online, especially in blogs or other casual sources.
What are some of the books you would recommend?
Excellent book if you're looking to get into making your own herbal medicines is Making Plant Medicine by Rich Ocheck. Another is The Herbal Medicine Maker's Handbook by James Green. And if you're really interested in delving in deep and learning a lot more about the details of the plants, any of Michael Moore's books, particularly Medicinal Plants of the Mountain West and of the Pacific West, those two books are excellent resources, very good photographs and illustrations, descriptions of when and how to harvest, how to prepare an ideal formulation. And a lot of that is backed up by traditional use that he's researched, but also by laboratory processes that he's followed through with himself. Some of the anecdotes in those books are really interesting, of like him drawing his own blood, looking at it under a microscope before and after taking a tincture and seeing a difference in metabolism and in the way that the fats are structured and things like that.
Talking about sources, where do you source your seeds for the live plants that you sell in the summer?
At home, my favorite seed catalogs are the ones that maybe don't even necessarily have as many pictures because they had a printing budget and they've just written a lot about each herb. So one of the books Yarrow mentioned is by an author named Rich Ocheck, who runs Strictly Medicinal Seeds out of Williams, Oregon. And so this person is both a practicing herbalist themselves and a plant cultivation nerd, entrepreneur, aficionado. Strictly Medicinal Seeds is the name of the company. And if you do what I've done and sign up to receive their catalog by mail, it in itself is quite an incredible piece of literature for you, just their seed catalog. I'd love to get their seeds in here so we can have them locally. We'll see what happens this winter, but we do start a number of medicinal herb starts that then will be for sale in the store each spring, and a lot of those come from Strictly Medicinal Seeds. It's really reliable. We're able to put that full Latin botanical name on anything we start from them because we're confident that they are being specific with what they're growing.
So I guess, could you let the audience know where your shop is located?
Yeah, so we are here at Woda Botanicals, which is a little herb shop that I opened just over a year ago now. We're on Lake Street, immediately across from SBS, the Builder Supply. And the goal here is to increase people's access to plant medicine and culinary delights. I mean, food is medicine too, as most of us probably know. And teas, lots of fine teas. So we're on Lake Street, easily accessible. A lot of the stuff is very affordable. My goal is to make this something that's approachable as part of our everyday life and pantry.
Is there anything else you guys wanted to say or add?
There are a lot of different dimensions to engaging with plants. And I like to encourage people to follow the threads that interest them, get to know plants on their own terms, both in the wild and, if you have the knack for it, in cultivated spaces. Bringing plants into our homes in the winter, that's something that I really enjoy personally, having the smells of these pungent plants that we can have just in our houses in the long, dark months here. But getting to know them in the wild in their own setting is also really powerful. And there are a lot of different ways to engage with plants, from cooking meals that we've been eating our whole lives to learning the plants that grow in the regions that we live in now. The possibilities are kind of endless, and it's reassuring to me when we can all start to have conversations around plants that can be as in-depth and meaningful as the conversations that we have about other things that we know about from TV shows or celebrities or politics. I think the plants offer us a lot in that regard for getting to know the world in a different way and being able to connect with each other and with our surroundings in a more deep and meaningful way.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And that was Carolyn Westbrook and Yarrow Hennett, recorded at WOTA Botanicals on October 23rd, 2020. They talked more in depth about making tinctures and other technical aspects of wildcrafting, which I did not have time to include in this episode, but it will be included with the show notes when this episode is posted to the KBBI website. That's kbbi.org, and click on the tab under programming that says Homer Grown. Coming up next, Kyra Wagner has our Tech Minute.
Hello, this is Kyra Wagner with Homer Soul and Water, and today our Tech Minute is going to cover drying herbs. If you'd like to dry some of your herbs from this year, there are lots of ways that you can do it, lots of gadgets and techniques. But one of the simplest, of course, is to just dry them by air. There are no gadgets required except possibly a rubber band. If you do want to try and meet that wonderful image of the bunches of herbs dangling in your kitchen, use a rubber band around the stem so that as they dry, the rubber band will continue to tighten and hold them rather than letting them fall about your kitchen. Another thing to keep in mind if you are air drying your herbs is that a lot of herbs have volatile oils that can actually be destroyed or ruined as you dry them if they are being dried in the sun. So it's really best to dry things in the dark and in a warm area with lots of air circulation. If you have a microwave, however, that gadget is a new technique. You can put those herbs in the microwave for about a minute, pop it open, and give them the crumble test. If they crush and shatter when you squeeze them in your hand, they're ready to be stored. If they don't, you can put them back in the microwave for another 30-second interval and try again. If you don't have a microwave, but you do have a dehydrator, you can dry just about anything from meat to fruit to your herbs. Herbs require very little heat, so setting it at the lowest setting is the best. The good thing about a dehydrator is that because it is blowing a very specific temperature of air over your herbs for a specific amount of time, you can often dry herbs that are much thicker than you'd be able to dry in open air. An example would be chamomile that has bulky little flowers. You can also dry mint and basil and rosemary and all of your other herbs, but the thick ones you want to make sure are dry all the way through so that they don't mold when you go to put them in the jar for long-term keeping. It's not as easy to do a crumble test with chamomile, but that's still a good way to test if they're ready to be stored. Now, if you don't have any of these gadgets, you can also heat that air up a little bit by baking them in your oven. If you run it for about 30 minutes at the lowest setting, and then check, you can get your herbs dehydrated in the ordinary oven that all of us have in our homes. So this has been Kyra Wagner with the Tech Minute, talking about some gadgets and techniques for drying your herbs.
I'm Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of agriculture-related opportunities and other fun tidbits. The Homer Office of NRCS and Homer Soil and Water are proud to announce our winter-spring series of talks called Know Your Land. This series of talks was started last fall as a way for local landowners to understand and improve their gardens, soils, and other aspects of working with and caring for their lands. Twice a month, fall through spring, NRCS and Homer Soil and Water staff will lead presentations with plenty of time for questions and answers with members of the public. The first topic of the series will be Factors of Erosion, led by NRCS's Dorian Perez. We will discuss water erosion, wind erosion, and stream bank erosion, and ways landowners can reduce it. Dorian will also cover NRCS's EQIP program and ways it can help you. This year, the talks will be held online by using Zoom meetings. No need to leave your couch, and people from around the state are welcome to join in. There will be two sessions for this talk and every other Know Your Land talk throughout the whole season, one at lunchtime and one in the evening. This is to accommodate people no matter what your schedule is. You can find the link for this talk and all others at Homer Soil and Water's website at www.homerswcd.org. And if you're new to using Zoom, don't fret. Just contact me. I'll help walk you through how to join a Zoom webinar. I'm happy to do so. Just contact me at Nicole, N-I-C-O-L-E, at homerswcd.org. By email, I'll get you squared away. And one more exciting piece of news. The 5th Annual Alaska Food Festival and Conference is right around the corner, happening November 6th and 7th. This is Alaska's premier gathering in honor of and in service to local food in Alaska. That's everything from growing our own to subsistence harvesting, initiatives around the state, and policy to help make it stronger. This is an opportunity to hear local, regional, and national speakers on a variety of food security, production, business, and community food issues, with a special emphasis on rural and indigenous food systems and food entrepreneurship. The conference will also offer chef and food preparation demonstrations and virtual farm and processing facility tours. Want in? Register at the Alaska Food Policy Council's website. They're at www.akfoodpolicycouncil.org. And happy Halloween!
And that's it for this episode. I want to thank Carolyn Westbrook and Yarrow Hinnant of Woda Botanicals for talking to us about wildcrafting and herbs. The folks at Homer Soil and Water Conservation District for providing content for this episode. Local musicians Carly Conomac and Kevin Cope for our intro music. Ryan Black for our interstitial music. And Kevin Cope and Ryan Black for the outro music that you are listening to right now. We tentatively have one more episode planned for this first season. Questions, comments, and criticisms can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer.